two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy 2024! New year, new you, right? Let me guess. You're thinking about joining a new gym, starting a fad diet, buying that Theragun everyone's always yammering on about. I've got a better idea. Listen to my podcast. I'm Samantha Bee, writer, comedian, and host of Choice Words from Lemonada Media. This whole month of January, we're going to help you make better choices in 2024. We'll go beyond superficial hacks and get at the truth of how to lead a more meaningful life. Just search for Choice Words on your podcast player of choice and hit follow so you don't miss an episode. Now that is a good choice.
Lemonada.
Hey there, it's Julian Castro. Happy holidays to you and your loved ones on behalf of the entire Our America team. Hopefully this year, as more folks get their booster shots and kids are starting to get vaccinated as well, you'll have a chance to safely celebrate together as a family at home. I know that's what we're going to do down here in San Antonio, and I hope that you have a chance to do that as well. Well, this week we wanted to share one of our most talked about episodes of the year, featuring TV personality Jonathan Van Ness. The Queer Eye star sat down with me to talk about their personal journey battling addiction, society's continued bias against HIV-positive individuals, and the promise of the Biden-Harris administration. And a quick warning, there's definitely some colorful language, but trust me, it's all worth the listen. Hope you enjoy. After nearly a year of living with the coronavirus, it continues to dominate the national conversation.
The CDC says more than 10 million Americans have been vaccinated.
This newly opened center in Brooklyn will run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, one of five in New York City.
To get as many people vaccinated as possible, officials in Ohio are...
On the one hand, the speed at which we've been able to develop the vaccine has been nothing short of miraculous. But on the other, it hasn't come soon enough for hundreds of thousands of Americans who have ultimately fallen victim to the virus, despite the heroic efforts of our nation's medical workers. The mystery and devastation of the virus has caused some to draw connections to the AIDS crisis of the 1980s.
It's mysterious, it's deadly, and it's baffling medical science. Acquired immune deficiency syndrome. And every day, three more cases are identified, and yet still, surprisingly few people are familiar with the Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome, or the acronym by which it's frequently identified, AIDS.
About 700,000 Americans, including many who identified as LGBTQ+, lost their lives to the HIV epidemic. At the beginning of the epidemic, HIV was dismissed as a gay man's disease, and the Reagan administration shamefully slow-walked the federal response to find a cure. But over the years, medical advances have been made to combat the virus. Now, many folks who live with HIV lead happy and healthy lives, including my guest this week, Jonathan Van Ness.
We're going to have a quick little heel walking
lesson.
Yes! When you're walking in heels, it's all about confidence. So I go like, see how she's just like a little...
On the hit Netflix show, Queer Eye, Jonathan uses his vivacious personality and experience as a hairstylist to help people improve their appearance.
Oh my God, she was just like, heels, mwah, yes. Love.
But he's also a strong advocate for healthcare reform, HIV testing, and LGBTQ rights. This week, I talk with Jonathan about his journey through testing positive for HIV, overcoming addiction, and fighting for policies that can help tackle stigma against HIV status. And at a time when good news can be hard to come by, a huge congratulations is in order to Jonathan, who just recently got married. This is Our America. I'm your host, Julian Castro.
I just need to keep reminding myself that I'm not hosting this time. You're hosting.
Maybe we'll be like a double host or something like that, you know?
No, I just gotta like get out of that zone of hosting. Yeah.
Hey, the last time that you and I talked, we spoke before the election. How are you feeling these days?
I mean, I am feeling concerned, actually. I'm feeling a lot of concern. And I've really been thinking a lot about this idea of, like, the Democrats need to do a better job of working across the aisle within our own party. Like, what we really need to do is learn how to work between centrists and progressives. Because at the end of the day, I do feel that we all want the same thing. But I do think that they're coming from a rural Midwestern town of, you know, Quincy, Illinois, where I come from, that votes, you know, for Trump 2-1. I think he won even by a higher standard in 2020 than he did in 2016 in my hometown. Because I just couldn't agree more with the Cori Bushes and the AOCs and the squads of the world. That's where my heart is. I'm like, we don't need to make other people comfortable. Fuck them. However, in rural America, I think that the points we need to not compromise on our points, but is there a way we can communicate and get everyone on the same page with love and respect? And I don't know how we're going to do it. So yeah, anxious, worried, a little relieved. I mean, we did just have like 106, Republican Congress people. And we also have like Tommy Tuberville and fucking Mo Brooks, excuse my French, but fuck. So even though we did win, it's like, we still have 106 elected officials, you know, that are representing the 75 million people that are trying to overturn elections. So I just feel a little stressed, Secretary Castro.
I wanted to take a step back. You mentioned growing up in Quincy, Illinois, very different from the life you live now in New York, but you grew up as an LGBTQ youth in a small town in a very different time, even though, you know, in the scope of things, you know, it's not like we're talking 50 years ago or, you know, even 30 years ago. Talk to me about growing up in that small town, what that was like, and reflecting back on it, what you learned from that experience that you carry with you now.
Well, one thing I would say is that I often find myself cautioning folks against when I hear, and like, obsessed with you, by the way, but when we think about like, oh, it was a different time. If you're in like New York, maybe Miami, like Minneapolis, I don't know, like bigger cities, you know, yes, maybe it's a different time. Yes, I'm sure there has been progress. But when you're talking about Quincy, when you're talking about rural America, no, I don't think that there has been a lot of progress made. Actually, we haven't made that. We need to make a lot more progress. But to speak to the era in which I came up in, it was the age of DOMA. It was the age of, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act that was very aggressively pushed by the Clinton administration in the 90s. And I am of the era where it was very much like, you know, I don't think you should be killed for being gay, but you certainly shouldn't be married. That is a, you know, that is a sanctity between a man and a woman. So that was like something that we heard a lot. And this very just like with a smile on your face, like, no, you actually don't have the right to the same life and liberty and pursuit of happiness that we do, because Jesus said so, which is so ironic in a country that was like founded on the separation of church and state. It gets me all the time. Growing up in my school, it was like, to this day, as an adult, if I hear someone say faggot, I'm very quick to turn my head and put my arms up or be like, have fist clench. I still walk to my car with like keys facing out. I'm ready to defend myself at all times. I was pushed downstairs, like large flights of stairs. I was like shoved into walls. I had faggot spray painted on my car like several times. My house vandalized several times. Yeah, I mean, it's PTSD. I mean, I know what it's like to walk into a room at any given time and not know if my physical safety was going to be guaranteed. And when I look at my 20s and I look at like the high risk situations that I was so willing to put myself into, I mean, extremely dangerous situations, it didn't seem that out of the ordinary for me, given what I had already been up against. Like my sense of self and my sense of my right to protection, my right to freedom, safety, all of that, it had been so compromised from growing up in that environment, which is a lot bigger than society. But, you know, what happens in society trickles its way into homes and it trickles its way into, you know, individuals. And so,
yes, we have marriage equality, but for the individuals, like, actually, you know, living their lives in rural America and largely in lots of different parts, even if you're not in rural America, we have so much work to do.
When you were 25 years old, you were diagnosed with HIV. Could you talk to me about the moment that you found out that you had HIV and what happened in your life after that?
Yeah, it was terrible. It was just as shitty as you would imagine getting diagnosed with HIV would be in St. Louis, Missouri at 25 years old. At, you know, a Planned Parenthood that I'm very grateful for and is very clean and very nice and the people are very sweet. But yeah, I mean, I hadn't felt good. I had been engaging in a lot of self-destructive behaviors, which wasn't exactly new. So I had had scares before. I had had times where I was like, oh, like, is this going to be the time? And it had not yet caught up to me. But this time I was feverish and I was really fatigued and like not feeling normal for like a week based off of some of the relapses and some of the things that had been happening. I was like, I need to get tested. And so I went to get tested. And I did a rapid test and they were like, we'll be back in 10 minutes. And the 10 minutes turned to 20 and the 20 turned to 30. And then I saw like feet walking outside the door and there was one pair of feet and then two pairs of feet. And then I was like, this is that part in Sex and the City where like they go to tell Samantha, but I know they're not going to tell me to like stop being a slut because I didn't even tell her that I was being such a slut. So I'm not about to get lectured about, say, did you see that episode of Sex and the City where like Samantha gets tested for HIV in like the late 90s? And
no, I didn't catch that one.
There's an episode of Sex and the City where Samantha goes to get an HIV test. And she tells the doctor that, you know, when they're doing their pre-screening questionnaire and like Samantha answers yes to every single question that the doctor asks, it made her scared that she was going to have it. And she collapses on the way to the room. And then when they come out of this scene, they say her test was negative, but the doctor just wanted to lecture her on safer sex practices. Mm. I mean, I saw that when I was maybe like 12 or 13 and was like, but that wasn't, I mean, the origins of my zhuzhes of HIV stick, but that was like, I mean, way before that. There was a training lady who was like getting trained at the Planned Parenthood. And so when the lady who had taken my test came in, she was like, hey, would you mind? Robin's new here. And would you mind if Robin just, you know, came in to see? And I was like, no, I don't want fucking Robin sitting here to learn that I've got HIV. Get out! And so they're like, oh, Jesus, okay. Like, you know, so then Robin
You were not in the mood.
Not in the mood. I'm not going to be your guinea pig right now. And, she sat me down and she said, you know, your preliminary test results are positive. And I just put my head in my hands and an awful sob. And, you know, you have, like, I had just lost my stepdad 3 months prior to that after, like, a three-year, like, horrific battle with, like, bladder and brain cancer where I saw this, you know, person that had taught me so much and who I loved so much just be stripped of every ounce of their dignity on the way out the door, and to see my mom go through that. And I was just so traumatized at that point. And so I think that that was really, it wasn't like after that, I never had an issue again. I think I really struggled with my diagnosis for the first year. I was still struggling with self-destructive behaviors after that. But I learned very quickly that the HIV social safety net in Missouri was not one that was going to be good for me. And once I had my first meeting with, you know, my real doctor, I mean, she straight up said to me, she was like, if you can get to California, I would go there. Because at the, you know.
So she was indicting the healthcare system there in,
yes,
in Missouri.
And she said at the level she, because I, you know, I think I made $9,000 total. Like that's what my taxes were in that year. And she was like, the level of income that you have and the and what we have here versus what you would get in California, if you can figure it out, I would go. And so I was like, I'm out.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Before the break, we heard Jonathan describe how his doctor encouraged him to seek better HIV treatment outside of Missouri, which was exactly the sort of practical advice Jonathan needed to navigate his diagnosis and society's stigma.
I mean, the judgment and the stigma of STI testing in Missouri at the time, because I'd been to a doctor several times before that, in walk-ins and stuff, and felt very unwelcome and very judged. Like, it's like there's pictures of fucking, like, Jesus on the walls everywhere, and they're like, you use protection, right? And you're like,
So yes. You felt pressure not to tell them the truth, not to be honest.
Absolutely. And if you did start to answer honestly, the judgment was, I mean, literally things like, maybe next time you cannot do that. Saying that to a sexually compulsive person is not a great idea. If I could just not do that next time, do you think I'd fucking be here in the first place? No. So that day was awful. And then I did. And at that point, I knew that my health and my life was on the line. And I started researching about ARTs and antiretroviral therapies and learning about what undetectable meant and learning about what viral loads meant. And I knew at that point, I was like, I need to get to medication. I need to get to a doctor. I need to get on medication, because I knew that was before people were saying undetectable equals untransmittable. But there was still a school of thought at the time that you want to get on meds because you want to get that viral load down and you want to get into being undetectable because it's easier on your organs and it like lessens your complications in future. So at that point I was like, Mom, I'm selling everything I have to be able to like get out of this apartment and move back to California. And obviously I don't have the money for like a rental truck or anything like that. So I'm just going to pack up my Kia, this couch I couldn't sell and this other thing I couldn't sell. No one wanted it. And you actually co-signed this lease for me accidentally. You might want to go clear it out because I'm out. And so she was like, son of a bitch. Got signed up with AHF, and which is the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. Got signed up with Ryan White funding. I got signed up with ADAP, which is the AIDS Drugs Assistance Program. I had to go to like, you know, four different buildings, like all these different packets to, you know, confirm, you know, my income before I could get access to my doctor there. But it happened within like 10 days, and I was on my medication within a week after moving to LA, and had my follow-up appointment 2 weeks after that. And within 3 weeks of moving to LA, I was undetectable, had my doctor, you know, had my three-month checkups.
Your HIV diagnosis and the treatment that you've gone through has given you like a front row seat to the highs and the lows of our healthcare system. What do you want for policymakers out there to understand about our healthcare system? And what do you hope is done with healthcare over the next few years?
I think that the Affordable Care Act was a really good start. I will say that as someone who was struggling to get sober, newly HIV positive, and 25, I probably could have learned Mandarin almost as easily as I could have signed up for the Affordable Care Act. The sites were incredibly user unfriendly. It was incredibly bureaucratic. It was incredibly frustrating. It was a nightmare. It took me months. I had to go to multiple places.
Just trying to understand what all of it meant. And
oh, yeah. Like, what does this plan mean? What does that plan mean? How do I input my forms to prove my income so that I don't lose my AIDS drug assistance program and I don't lose my AHF and I don't lose my Ryan White funding, because I need those subsidies from Affordable Care Act so that I can get my meds? Because otherwise, if I didn't have those subsidies, it was going to be like $300 and $400 a month with Affordable Care Act if I didn't qualify for those subsidies, because HIV medication is so expensive if you don't qualify for those subsidies. It just shouldn't be that hard. It should not be that hard. And it shouldn't be that hard for a few reasons. Two comes up right away, but First of all, what we know about HIV is that when you achieve and maintain that undetectable viral load through your ARTs, your antiretroviral therapies, which is like after you already are positive, you don't transmit the virus, and you have a life expectancy of like 50 to 75 years after diagnosis, which is insane. That's amazing compared to where we were in the 80s. We can stop this virus if every time someone gets HIV, ARTs. End of story. That's why we should be having antiretroviral, it's really why we should have Medicare for all, but as far as HIV AIDS is concerned, because of the public health threat nature of it, it should just be covered federally across the board. If you find out you have it, you're on meds. You have it after every 3 months, period. But see, when I talk to people like that, or when I say that to some folks, sometimes what people say to me in DMs and things and in real life sometimes is, well, I didn't go out and get HIV. I don't want to pay for them. But it's the thing with this is that like, this is like when you try to like, you're like, ew, I don't want to get a cab on the way home from the bar, like even though I'm drunk, so I'm just going to drive. You got a fucking DUI. That shit's $10,000 now. You should have just gotten the cab. And that is similar with HIV AIDS. The cost that we incur from people not getting medication and the virus continuing to spread, it's making all of our healthcare more expensive. It's making everything worse. And in fact, the HIV social safety net has been slashed and burned. Even in California, since I left California, what was so good about California, it's actually been made less expansive and harder for folks to maintain their coverage. And it's like, at what cost are we saving this money? Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. So what I want to see is less bureaucracy, simplification of processes for people living with HIV. I want to see bigger budgets for HIV social safety net. And I also want to see the federal government come in here, because we know that there is so much racism and transphobia and homophobia baked into the HIV social safety net. And for states that can't even keep voting places open, for states that have been so willfully racist, like for the duration of the union, we shouldn't be leaving it up to those state legislatures to make policy for the most marginalized people in our country, because they cannot be trusted, frankly. So that's what I think.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together, because y'all, season 2 is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
So talk to me about Queer Eye. Talk to me about the show and all the success and everything that has come with it.
Well, I mean, the experience of doing Queer Eye is such an amazing experience, because we get to meet so many amazing people, and it's just so much connection and getting to work through things. And I think people would really be surprised, because we shoot like 60 hours of footage that gets edited into like a 45-minute show. So there are so many aspects.
Wow, they get 60 hours that gets cut down to 45 minutes.
Easily, because wow. I mean, we shoot like Monday through Friday, and it's like 8-10-hour days. And so, you know, all 5 of us are working with our heroes on so many different things that never see the light of day in that edit. And so we're connecting so much with our heroes and learning so much about their stories. And even also, I when I was on tour and getting into stand-up comedy, one of the sets that I like to do the best, I've written a lot of material and I've done a lot of comedy in these last few years, but one of my favorite sets to do is talking about how I am in a constant state of shock. I was not famous and not a celebrity, and in like, bachelor apartment or a one bedroom apartment, overdrawing my checking account 17 times a week, like saving up so I could go buy a pair of heels from Payless. That was my 20s. So walking around like being a homeowner, like I feel like that episode of Sex and the City again, which I'm sure you didn't see this one as well. But Charlotte York, when she gets engaged to Trey McDougal and she's always wanted to be engaged and she can't stop like running her finger with her engagement ring across like all of the surfaces in her apartment. I feel like that. I used to think in my 20s, I was like, maybe I can be a homeowner by the time I'm like 50. Maybe 50, I would have had it together by then. And so I feel so grateful and blessed. And then really, I think the part of it that is the hardest for me to deal with is like just wanting everyone else. I want everyone else to have it too. Like, I want everyone else to be able to get their healing. Like, I got my healing. I want everyone else to get their healing. And not that it's perfect and not that I don't struggle with things still, but I want that for everyone else so bad. And I think that I kind of feel like I have this just low level of guilt. Like, I hate that there is still people suffering. And I just want to help people not suffer as much. So sometimes I wish, like, you know, thinking that, like, I fucked up someone's highlights was, like, the worst problem that I had. Or, like, how I was even going to get, like, my medication was my biggest problem. Like, I feel like I've learned so much more about the world. That's a part I think I didn't expect is, like, the pressure. And just, like, I know a lot more now. And I know a lot more people suffering and what they're up against, which sometimes makes what I was up against, like, feel like Paris Fashion Week. Even in Quincy.
Despite all of the, you know, significant progress that we've made, whether it's the first LGBTQ cabinet member that Joe Biden has announced, or of course marriage equality or other opportunities, and the changing of attitudes that has happened among a lot of Americans, for a lot of young people growing up out there, they still are subject to the same bullying, to the same sense of shame, the same harsh family environment. What would your advice be to someone who's 13 years old right now and is struggling with the same environment and challenges that you did?
That's a great question. One of the things that I've learned from my therapist is this idea of you visualize a safe space. And for me, my safe space was I was like on a turquoise beach, and my stepdad who'd passed away would often be there because he would be like in my vision, like the person who I could talk to and who could, you know, help me counsel through things. He'd been sober for 27 years and like he was just such a huge part of my life. So he would, when I was creating my safe space, which is the exercise that my therapist calls it, I would usually kind of vision him being there. And it's interesting because as a child growing up in Quincy, I was actually doing that not knowing that I was creating a safe space. I had my head in books all the time. A lot of Harry Potter, a lot of Bridget Jones, a lot of Calvin and Hobbes. I was glued to any figure skating and gymnastics competition on TV, so that for hours I would like choreograph carpet figure skating routines. For hours I would play Olympics by myself on like a neighbor's trampoline that I could like find to go pretend that I was going to be the next Shannon Miller or Dominique Dawes if I could stick this front flip. So it wasn't that I was visualizing safe spaces. I was actually creating little pockets of safe spaces where I could be, I could do things that no one else would see, but I felt, you know, free and engaged and really like being led by my joy and by what made me feel good in a world where I didn't really have that a lot. For young LGBTQ people that are growing up in an environment or a home or a society that does not accept them, finding your own pockets and your own passions, whether it's reading or something that you can learn about to get to bridge that gap until you can be in a place of self-sufficiency and independence where you can watch your figure skating in your family room or watch your Queer as Folk in the family room and not have to like turn it off or, you know, run away or whatever. So can you find a literal little corner somewhere to enliven yourself and chase your passion, and then it will get better. And I would also say, like, I wish I wouldn't have quit Spanish class and violin lessons. So if you play an instrument or if you're like in a foreign language class in school, like
stick
with that shit, because I bet you I would have probably like not got addicted to drugs. Maybe I would have. Who knows? But don't quit your musical instrument or your foreign language classes, young LGBTQ people, because it just gives you more opportunities.
I wish I'd had that advice from you back then. I sucked at mariachi band. It was both in Spanish, and I was supposed to play this instrument called the vihuela, which is like a small guitar or something. I was terrible. No musical talent whatsoever.
Maybe that's something you could chase and like you'd bring your childlike joy back out by maybe you try again. Maybe your fingers have found more nimbleness.
Perhaps. So Joe Biden is going to have this opportunity now starting in late January to hopefully right the wrongs of the Trump era and then take us forward. And you mentioned LGBTQ youth. I think there's a lot of hope for change when it comes to true equality in our country. What do you hope to see?
What I hope to see is the Equality Act repassed in this Congress and hopefully given a vote on the Senate floor. I hope to see the Violence Against Women's Act reinstated. I hope to see the bipartisan gun control legislation that was passed in 2018 actually receive a vote on the Senate and be passed. I want to see police reform. I want to see qualified immunity gone at the federal level and the state levels. I feel like it's like Ashley Marie Preston says, you can't heal what you don't reveal. And so a lot got revealed in 2020. And in a lot of ways, I think that that's actually really good feedback and really good information for us. So yeah, there were tragic aspects of it, but actually it was a lot of really important feedback for us if we can listen to it, even though it was really painful and uncomfortable. But sometimes I think about like, can we shift like what our perspective is on defining something? Because I don't think it has to be tragic, and it is tragic and somber that there was loss of life and COVID and economic destruction and, you know, continued racial injustice. But a lot of people had their eyes open to really necessary things. Moving on to what I hope 2021 can be, bear with me here, okay? What I hope 2021 can be an Olympic year. Please, can it be an Olympic year? Like, I already lost one Olympic year in 2020. If I don't see some gymnastics and some diving and some international competition in 2021.
We can summon up some Chariots of Fire theme music here.
Please! I need 2021 to be the year of sports, please, and more equality and healing and stuff. But like, if I miss another World Figure Skating Championship, like, I don't know if I can keep this up. Oh my God, I could rip this top off thinking about it. So if we could all just like stay home, wear our masks, get that good fucking vaccine so that we can go to Tokyo and win our third women's gymnastics gold medal in a row. That's what I need. That's what I'm talking about. Go USA!
The Affordable Care Act was a good start, but Jonathan's right. We need to do more to ensure that our most vulnerable populations, including our nation's LGBTQ youth, have access to the physical and mental health services they deserve.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Feeling decision fatigue about what to make for dinner? We get it. I'm Jane Black.
And I'm Liz Dunn. We're veteran food journalists, and as parents ourselves, we know how hard it can be to feed your family.
That's why we created Pressure Cooker, a podcast that offers practical strategies for navigating the marketing madness and cultural expectations around mealtime.
Each week, we'll check in with the experts. From social media diet trends to baby-led weaning and AI meal planning, we have all your food-related questions covered.
Listen to Pressure Cooker wherever you get your podcasts.